Accession number 24193, reel 19.
Mr. Towle, reel 19. Now, as you know, we don't go into particular details about your time with Shell, but what I would like to know is how your military experience and the sort of talents you'd exploited in the army were of value in the world of commerce, or otherwise, or, you know, perhaps they weren't of value, but how did your military training in a and experiences help you in with Shell?
I think, in my mind, without my military training, and bearing in mind I had no university degree, without my military training, I would not have got into Shell, because they saw a record, they liked it. They said, this man possibly can lead, and you need in business leaders. I found, having survived the coming down off your pedestal and entering the world of commerce, the many features from the army helped me. One was organization, reporting structures. It was terribly important to me in the army that one knew who one reported to and to whom reported to you, and you had little organigrams or organization charts which showed your the corporals reporting to the sergeants and the sergeants to the officers, the officer to his chain of command, and the business works in that sort of structure very well indeed. So that was a natural to me and helped a great deal. In the army you were constantly talking, speaking, organizing your thoughts in public. You were persuading people from real active situations like follow me into battle, or let's go and play water polo better, or let's go and march better, to business where you were, and I found increasingly that you had an organization in business that they needed leadership, they needed discussions, they needed interpersonal skills is the current expression. It's man management in the army, and it's exactly the same in commerce. I think the skill of addressing a group, I found as one went on in one's business career, you were often addressing, for example, groups of doubting analysts about your business. Why should investors invest in this business? Well, it was a similar story in the army. The organization, the ability to not be too verbose, but to get your message across, rather like the story of the bikini, it's brief, but it covers the essentials. And I think to get that across, providing, I think, an open disposition. The army is very open. Everybody knows you. They have a confidence in you, be it an NCO, an officer, or a commander of a battalion. In business, it's exactly the same. You've got to create an atmosphere of confidence and honesty and integrity. And all of those characteristics are demanded for the army as well as they are for business. And it doesn't automatically come if you come from a university course. I've noted in business that some terribly well-educated PhDs from the best universities are not able, for example, to talk to groups of people. They're not able to assess the essentials of an issue and then formulate a plan as to how you're going to handle it and so on. I found the organization of the first company I went to work at, in Shell Company of Thailand, in Bangkok, Thailand, an almost mirror image of a battalion. There'd be a commander. It was the general manager. Then he had divisions under him, administration, sales, operations, manufacturing, just like the army. And they had those divisions underneath them, the equivalent of platoons, areas, sales areas or whatever. So really one went from one horse to another, and it was identical. It was quite extraordinary how quickly one fitted in. And I think the army, I don't think I could not have done it without my army experience. I think being at the School of Infantry, handling groups of soldiers coming to be trained, helped a great deal. Talking with somebody who was dissatisfied in business is just the same as talking to a private so-and-so who has a problem at home. Exactly the same. In Thailand, of course, one was dealing with Thai nationals who were the, if you will, the privates and the non-commissioned officers. And at that time, the expatriates were the officers. Evolution has gone on, and there are no more expatriates anymore. It's now nationals that really run these companies. So the Shell Company of Thailand or the Shell Company of Australia were just like units and regiments in the British Army. And that was very clear, and it gave me a great comfort right the way through my business career.
Now, it's not the War Museum's main field, but if you could just very quickly sketch out the progress of your career, just so that they get an idea of what you managed to achieve.
Right,
that.
Well, I went to the Far East and my first job was not to speak Spanish, but to learn Thai. And Shell incentivized you by saying, well, if you don't speak Thai, you can't do your job properly and we might not have a need for you. So we were sent to learn Thai, and I learnt to read and write Thai. Jackie, of course, having been born in China, took to it like a duck to water. And it's a very tonal language, and she did very well. I then became a product manager, handling a particular product, then a district manager, just like the army, in South Thailand, the bit running down to from Bangkok to the Malaysian border. And I was responsible for all activity in that area. Having spent 4 years in Thailand, we were then posted to Montevideo, Uruguay, where the Spanish came into effect at last. And the only reason I think I was posted there is that the proper name of Uruguay is La República Oriental del Uruguay, Oriental. And in Shell, I think I had a description behind me of Orient, coming from the Orient. Therefore, my next posting should be the Orient. And they look up Uruguay, it says La República Oriental. So off we went to Montevideo, where we stayed for 6 years as sales manager, all entirely in Spanish. Again, another battalion. After that, to Buenos Aires, and then back to London to make sure that the Shell Center wanted to keep their tabs on you to see how you were developing. So I did an office job in Shell Center for a couple of years. Then was sent to Bogota, Colombia, where I ultimately became the battalion commander, or the head of Shell Colombia. And having survived that, and that was a production company, there were lots of guerrillas and problems around the Magdalena, and we had a camp called Kasabi, which was an old camp producing about 10,000 barrels a day of crude oil. Most of the property, which was enormous, on the west of the Magdalena, which flows northwards into the Caribbean, was occupied by guerrillas. And occasionally they would come and shoot up and there'd be a battle. I went to see the head of the guerrillas, had a meeting with him. We arranged arranged the meeting such that I was absolutely, I had two or three members of the company with me. I met with him at his camp, which had turkeys tied to the camp, which made good alarm signals, and we had a lunch and we discussed this, and we said we would support the villages that they commanded and controlled if they would stop attacking the villages where our employees were working. And we made a deal, which he honoured, and I honoured, and we had relative peace in the area. I remember giving the ferry between Barranca Bermeja and the west bank of the Magdalena, a huge, big ferry, which Shell didn't need anymore. I gave that to the town. And that sort of cemented relationships down there. And for the next 4 years, we had really no further murders or bank robberies or some of our wells being blown up. After that, I then went back to Shell Center, where I ran the Shell marine bunker business just about the time of the Yom Kippur War in 1973, when the lights of Europe went out virtually, and people were on a three-day week. And my job was to keep Shell's customers, shipping customers, afloat and moving. And that was really a most incredibly difficult exercise. The Norwegians are big ship owners, the Greeks are all big ship owners, and it was very funny being asked by a Niarchos or some of the great big Greek Chandros, Onassis, to go and meet with them in London in their magnificent apartments to talk about the supply of bunker fuel to their ships around the world, some stranded because of lack of fuel. And I felt it was like us inviting the pump attendant at a gas station into dinner to talk about, you know, the supply of fuel. That I found fascinating. Got through that. I then was promoted and became head of a Shell trading company called Shell International, Citco, Shell International Trading Company, which I did for 2 years, products and crude. And that included a lot of international stuff, including going to Peking, Beijing as it's now called, back to where I started in the Korean War, in a way. And we went to buy the first crude oil out of China that the West had ever bought. And I was there for about 3 months with a team of two others, senior people from Shell. And our routine was a two-hour meeting with the Chinese, mainly the Ministry of Energy and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And we'd meet for 2 hours in the morning. The afternoon we were entertained and shown the Great Wall and everything else, and many Chinese operas. And we were, after a while, running out of ideas of how to amuse us, waiting for the decisions from the Chinese. And on one desperate moment, I remembered, or had heard, that they had a museum of military history in Beijing. And I didn't tell them. I was obviously from Korea. But I said I would be very interested to see that, as I was a student of military history. And the team took it on board, and as they did, because they'd never make a decision without referring it to higher authority. 2 days later, back came the answer, Mr. Tal, we regret very much, but that our museum of military history is closed as we're rewriting our military history. I thought that was very interesting and very, very poetic. And probably a realistic answer. And the other event I remember, we were trying to get an audience with the Minister of Foreign Trade, and it was going on and on and on, but we were promised it. And I was in the bath one day in the evening. None of the hotel's doors in the Friendship Hotel in Beijing had locks on them. And I was in the bath, up to my neck in very hot water, reading. And suddenly the door of the apartment was of the room was flung open, the bathroom was flung open, and there was our lady interpreter, Miss Ting, saying to me, "You must come now to see the minister." And she stood there. And I said, "Well, I need to get up out of the bath. Will you go?" She said, "No, no time for that." Handed me the towel and almost helped rub me down. And we got to see the minister, and we bought our crude. And the mission was a success. But it was such in Beijing at that time that a taxi would come for us to go to the ministry for our meetings. And one of the three of us would accidentally leave a pair of gloves. It was January, February, very cold, in the taxi. Do you know, that pair of gloves, or scarf, or whatever it was, would be returned not only to the hotel, but to the room of the individual who'd left it. No names on the gloves, no, but they knew that it was from such and such a person, and he was in room such and such. Anyway, it was an experience. And from there, I then went to New York and became general manager of a company called Scallop, or Asiatic Petroleum Corporation. The East remained a part of my life forever.
Was this part of Shell or this...
This was part of Shell. In fact, it was the company was formed at the turn of the last century to watch what Mr. Rockefeller was doing. Who was the Standard Oil of New Jersey, or the Exxon man. And the mission then, at the time of founding that company, was to report market information back to the center. By then it had, when I went, it had a business role, and I carried out that role. From there, I resigned, or retired, I'm not sure which word, I think in about early 80s, 82-ish, and went to Hawaii. I was headhunted to run a company in Hawaii, running a refinery, and fascinating. I established a chain of gas stations and so on a lot of the Pacific islands, where many English people had trodden before. Very, very interesting. In American Samoa, where the governor met me, and he was a Samoan, an enormously big man, met me at the airport, and we chatted and got in the car, and were being driven to Pango Pango, which is the capital of American Samoa. And after a little while, he said, "You're not American, are you?" And I confessed to this sin, and he said, "We had another Englishman here in Pango Pango. Do you want to see his house?" So I said, "Yes." We were still on our way from the airport. And so he took me to Somerset Maugham's house, where he wrote Rain. And so the governor was one up. I then said, "Well, I went to Somerset Maugham's school, which was the King's School, Canterbury." And he said, "Well, he wrote a very good book here called Rain." I noted that. And I then said that I had a small scholarship from Somerset Maugham as I wrote a story about an air raid on Canterbury and got a small prize for 5 years. He also noted that in a Samoa, which was just visible on the horizon, Robert Louis Stevenson was buried there. So it was very interesting, that point of view. And I then helped sell that company to Broken Hill Proprietary of Australia, and then stayed on in New York and became a director of small struggling companies. And I continue to do that today, living both in America and here in Kent.
Now, just finally, you've sort of reawakened your contacts with the Royal Norfolk.
Yes.
Can you tell us about your membership of the Regimental Association and why it's become more important to you now to keep contacts?
I was, having moved to the Americas, it was never really possible to participate in any of the regimental events. One was always not there. And to be honest, I let it, as one's career went forward, to be honest, I let it disappear from my radar screen. And I'm rather ashamed to say there was a 20, 30-year gap between the regiment and me from my time in the Americas onwards. However, we came back to Britain in the mid-90s, 1990, and I started being contacted by members of my platoon who'd found me, And I think behind this all was John Denny, who'd done some incredible research. He had found and remembered, and we corresponded at the beginning, but then we all went, after I left the regiment, we all went our separate ways. And people apparently at regimental dinners would say, as they would and do, do you ever see, what was that man's name, Tony Flannel, Tony Towel? No. We think he's dead. Haven't heard anything of him. John Dennis decided to find out, and I know that he went to Shell Centre, and said, look, I'd like to track down this man. Well, Shell don't normally do that. They don't give out addresses of their employees. But somehow John found me in, I would think, 1997. And it was the greatest thrill of my life to get a call from John Denny here in this house to say, well, we've found you, you're not dead, come and be involved with the regiment, please. And I said, like a shot. I absolutely did. And that day, I remember it so clearly, say in 1997, I must have had 14 telephone calls from starting with the John Denny call in the morning. And he must have passed it all the way around. I had one from Ginger Nutt, I had one from Bill Henson, and other, Mike Gunton, other officers that I had been my colleagues, soldiers that had been in my platoon, both in C Company and in the machine gun. John Denny's a span of control was particularly in the machine gun platoon. And John Denny, bless his cotton socks, was persistent enough to make sure that I attended the regimental officers' dinner, held in June every year in Norwich, both the night before with officers and the next day officers and their wives, and then the number getting smaller and smaller, of course, then attending at Norwich Cathedral, where the regimental chapel is, and honours are, you know, and the colours are there, and then Corporal Minard got hold of me, who was one of my corporals in C Company, and I went to a regimental event in Northamptonshire, which is where he lives. And it was particularly funny. I mean, there was an enormous, enormous crowd, and it was very poignant. Corporal Minard sort of said, well, here's Tony Towle, and would you come up on the stage? And not many people have seen him for a long time, but here he is, and I waved and said hello. And then he turned round and said, I believe you were looking for this man too, Tony. And he produced Corporal Guest, who was second in command to Jonathan Wormald on his patrol that we've talked about earlier. And it was amazing. I didn't find Corporal Guest. He was badly wounded. Captured. He was lying in the trench with them at the time that we were looking on the surface, about, I would guess, 20, 30 yards away from the enemy, and they were still firing. But John was, and I met a lot of people, and Ginger Nutter was there. One of the funny events, actually, at the Northamptonshire reunion with the soldiers. My wives were invited. Again, I was most impressed with the standard of the national servicemen they'd all gone on and done well. The standard of the wives. They'd all been really remarkably prosperous. I hope it was their military training. A group of my platoon and associates came round, and we were having a drink after the dinner, and I took my map with me to show them, you know, the bits where we were, and they didn't know. And my wife couldn't bear this after a while, and she said in a loud voice, I don't know why on earth you followed him. You know, he has no sense of direction whatsoever. And there was a deathly pause, and then a hoot of laughter went up. John Denny then got me involved in the regimental dinner association of the regiment in the TA barracks in Norwich, and I've attended that, sitting amongst the machine gun platoon, who today, and I went to one on the 30th of September this year, in 2002, and they were asking after my dog. My dogs in Hong Kong, James Pig and Lady, and how they would take them for illicit drives in the carriers and so on, all of which I didn't know, and I'm still hearing stories. So I've done that now. I'm so happy. I've volunteered to General Sutherall to help in any way I can with the Regimental Association. Numbers are getting smaller. And, of course, the amalgamation of the Suffolk, the Essex, the Royal Norfolk, the Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire, all into the Royal Anglian Regiment, has made the territorial proprietariness sort of less and less and less. So in the Royal Anglian Regiment today, there is a Royal Norfolk Company. And those serving soldiers and officers will attend some of these reunions. But the famous Major General, Sir Jack Dye, come to these events. Brian Dillon, Tom Stiles, John Jones from Hong Kong, who got an MBE for the flooding in Norfolk when he was a soldier, are all now coming to these, and it's a moment of great pride, and I'm so thrilled that I now belong back to the Royal Norfolk Regiment. And Sir Jack Dye was very funny. When I met for the first time, he, in his rather sort of, you know, gruff voice, "Well, Tal, you know, we're glad you're back. We always knew you'd have done well. You'd have been a general like me, and you'd probably got a K." And somebody else in the background said, "Yes, and broke like the rest of us." So we all roared with laughter, but it is so good to be back.
Thank you very much.